Welcome, everyone, to Bitcoin Optech newsletter number 417. Today, we're going to talk about a draft BIP for Stale Tip Relay. We have our monthly segment on changing consensus, which, as usual lately, is pretty beefy. We're going to talk about cross-input signature aggregation. We have a handful of post-quantum related changing consensus discussions as well. And then we'll move to releases. We have the SecP release, and then we have a bunch of notable code and documentation changes. Merch, Gustavo, and I are joined by some guests this week. We'll have them introduce themselves briefly. Conduition, who are you?
Hey, Mike. Hi, I'm Conduition. I'm a freelance and open source engineer and researcher, now focused primarily on post-quantum stuff and funded by Brink.
Ram?
Hey, my name is Ram. I also go by pseudo Ramdom on the internet. I'm an open source contributor / researcher at Localhost Research, primarily working on Bitcoin Core. Thanks for having me here.
Fabian?
Hey, I'm Fabian. I'm a Bitcoin open source contributor and I'm supported by Brink.
Thanks for joining us. We appreciate your time. We're going to rearrange for listeners who are following along. We'll go a little bit out of order in deference to our guests. So we're going to jump to changing consensus. We have a few items that Conduition is going to help us get through on the quantum front that I saw that he was engaged with on delving. The first one, PQC output type discussion. So Conduition, you know, nearly everyone in these discussions agrees that Bitcoin may eventually need and should put some time toward a researching post-quantum and maybe a new address type that can survive quantum computers. Maybe the problem, or maybe not a problem, but one consideration here is that there's about a half dozen of these different designs, each being debated in their own thread, some on the mailing list, some on Twitter, some on Delving. And so Peter Willa opened up a thread to sort of put them all in one table and then compare them head to head. Maybe I'll just leave that as the intro. Maybe you can talk a little bit about like what aspects things are being compared on and maybe what, you know, some of the important candidates or distinctions are between the different candidates.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. Peter's post here does a great job at summarizing it, so I'll try not to regurgitate too much. I would highly recommend you read it first, but the major salient trade-offs of any post-quantum output type in a quantitative sense is its efficiency, how cheap it is to spend, but also there's qualitative properties, like is it secure against a quantum computer without follow-up? And that's one of the main like debate points between the different output types that are under consideration. And there's even some subtlety there in that question, because there's one output type called pay to taproot hash, which is secure until you spend from it. So there's a lot of different subtleties, and Peter does a great job at summarizing them all. He separates his posts. The first one is purely factual, unopinionated, and it goes over the different trade-offs in a very unbiased way. I really appreciate that. And then he separates out his own stance and what he would recommend into his second post. And his recommendation was to deploy pay to taproot v2 and pay to Merkle root, which are two different output types in tandem, or perhaps in a staggered release fashion. And these two address types will do very different things for different people.
Did he, so Peter recommended both, because I know I've seen you and him going back and forth on pay to Merkle root versus pay to taproot v2. He's saying do both?
Yeah. There's two different perspectives generally in this debate. There's the absolute security perspective, which is that if we want a post-quantum output type, it should be post-quantum. We shouldn't have to, you know, do some sort of follow-up fork to close up a security hole later. But then there's the migrationist perspective, which is that we want to maximize the incentive for everyone to migrate as soon as possible so that we don't have to deal with things like rescue protocols, or at least if we do, the fallout of instituting rescue protocols will be much less and will be less worrisome. And both have their merits and both have their trade-offs, but deploying both output types, as Peter is saying, will appease both camps.
Sorry, could you explain which of the two is only post-quantum? Because I thought that Pate Merkle root would also have ECDSA signatures in the output, in the script path, and Pate to Taproot V2 would not be only post-quantum either. So I don't really understand.
Great question. So there's a lot of subtlety here in which signature types are available on which outputs, and there's different options. Pate Merkle root, as it's currently defined, will support both classical and post-quantum signatures. So it's theoretically possible to use Pate Merkle root in a quantum secure way, as long as you never expose your elliptic curve public keys to a quantum attacker. And the point that that Peter makes and that Antoine has made before in the mailing list debates is that that's a big ask. And there is an option to deploy Pate Merkle root without classical elliptic curves. That's what SIPA calls P2QR, Pate quantum resistant. This one, I don't know of anybody actively pursuing this path, primarily because, well, if you were wanting to deploy Pate QR, you would want to deploy a different output type alongside it, because otherwise nobody would migrate to Pate QR before Q-Day. And then we would still run into the problem of having to, you know, rescue a whole bunch of coins. A lot of people might get hacked. So it doesn't seem like a desirable option for most people.
Right, because of course, so spending Pate, from Pate to QR would incur huge scripts due to the quantum resistant signature scheme.
Exactly, unless there were some massive witness discount or SNARK verification, which we can talk about in a bit. But as to your question, yes, there's Pate Merkle root, Pate Taproot V2. They both support classical and post-quantum signatures. The difference is in whether the public keys that you validate against are hidden behind a hash or not. In the case of Pate Merkle root, everything is hidden behind hashes. And in the case of Pate Taproot V2, we post a bare public key on chain, just as in Pate Taproot.
Right. So Pate Merkle root, the argument would just be that it's resistant to long range attacks because the public key material is not visible until it's reused or a transaction is in the mempool. Okay, yes. I thought you meant quantum resistant as in with quantum resistant signature scheme and only that as its only spending option. But as you clarified, that is now referred to as Pate to QR.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's good to distinguish because it avoids confusion as to what exact spending conditions are available. I think P2QR could be viable, but it would require a lot of other technologies like SNARK signature aggregation to be economically viable.
Maybe that's a good segue to one of my follow-up questions. You, Conduition, pointed and encouraged listeners to read the source material on what Peter put together. Unfortunately, Peter couldn't join us, so we will encourage people to go read that firsthand. But since we do have you, and you added some contributions to that thread, there's two pieces that I pulled out at least. There's the potential, like you were talking about Fabian, who's here, his CISA proposal for signature aggregation, and then there's also block-wide PQ SNARK aggregation. So maybe you want to double-click on both of those.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's some great interplay between many different proposals like Fabian's and post-quantum migration. And I hadn't thought about this until recently. So it's kind of been changing my mind a little bit on this post-quantum output type debate and making me rethink what's going on, what the best options are. So maybe we should do a little brief thing on CISA before we talk about how CISA affects post-quantum. Maybe I'm not the best person to talk about this since we have the author of CISA in the room here.
Fabian, do you want to, spoiler alert, your other item by sort of summarizing it briefly here, and then we can dig in maybe a little bit deeper later?
I think for the purpose of this question, maybe we can just remind people that CISA means that multiple transaction that has multiple inputs, which typically corresponds to multiple signatures. With CISA, those could be aggregated into a single signature, which is smaller. And there are two different types, one which roughly halves it, and the other one makes it a constant size. I think it creates a lot of space savings on the chain in terms of the signatures. I think that's enough for now for this conversation.
Yes, and the fact that CISA exists is really awesome because Fabian's proposal introduces a new output type by necessity. In order to institute and deploy CISA, you need a new output type because the validation rules are changed. And that would be a hard fork if you just introduced it on Peta Taproot. And this new output type that CISA proposes could exactly be Peta Taproot V2. All you need to do is introduce a new leaf version that supports post-quantum signatures. I say all you need to do. I mean, there's a lot of work that goes into that, of course, but this means that the CISA output type and the Peta Taproot V2 output type could just be the same thing. And that provides a really cool incentive because CISA has asymptotic efficiency, like as the number of inputs grows, of just about like 1 or 2 bytes per input. And you only need a single signature for all the inputs in a given transaction, in the best case. But that is contingent on using Schnorr signatures. And this is all based on discrete log, which is broken by quantum computers. And so while CISA does incentivize people to migrate, and then everyone will be on addresses with post-quantum cryptography, we won't be able to use CISA after Q-Day, if Q-Day happens.
Condition, maybe you can elaborate on where you left off there, because I'm with you that you can't aggregate post-quantum signatures, and so there's not a magic bullet, which I've always hoped for in years past, where you just, these signatures are large, but you can aggregate them, right? So we can't do that. So what you're saying is we have a Peta Taproot V2 that is CISA enabled, which would help with what, even if it's not helping with post-quantum?
Sorry, I should clarify. Because CISA is so efficient, people who may not care at all about quantum cryptography could migrate to it and would have incentive to migrate to it to save money. And that would put more people onto addresses and wallets that use a hidden post-quantum fallback leaf in their Peta Taproot V2 script tree. And so if the soft fork that disables key spending is deployed in time, then all those people who migrated will be safe almost by accident, because they may not have even intended to secure their funds against quantum computers, but just by following incentives, they did so. Now, Merch, I think you had your hand there.
Yeah. So one of the ideas behind Peta Taproot V2 was, because it doesn't give a financial incentive, the idea would be that people only switch over once they also add a post-quantum resistant leaf in their script tree. If we now give a financial incentive to switch to Peta Taproot V2, wouldn't we expect that more people switch to Peta Taproot V2 due to the financial incentive without actually going the extra step and adding the post-quantum leaf? So wouldn't we set ourselves up to those people being rugging themselves per this footgun?
That is possible. However, every description of Peta Taproot V2 that I've seen, and in this case, that's what we're talking about, has included a contract, a sort of social agreement implicit in its use, where if you want to use this output type, you need to have a post-quantum fallback. If you don't, you are submitting your coins for confiscation. Because the part of Peta Taproot V2 that everybody debates about so much is that eventually we have to disable the key spend path. Otherwise, all the coins can be stolen by a quantum computer. And if you opt yourself out of that, you know, any user can destroy their coins if they really want to. And this would be exactly that.
Right. I think that Peter mentioned in this context that the tripwire plays an important part in the social contract, simply because you don't necessarily have to negotiate the soft fork to disable the EC spending. If you build it into the output type from the very beginning, to be triggered by any participant that can show the proof that a output without a keypath spend has been spent. And so if you construct a pay-to-taproot output, you can use something called a nums point or nothing up my sleeve point. And the idea would be that there would be some such nums points used to create outputs. And if someone can prove that they used a nums point and their output was still spent with a keypath spend, then that would be proof that a quantum computer was used to derive the key that underlies the nums point, which the user of the nums point couldn't have known, and thereby quantum computers are real and the EC path is disabled. So having the tripwire in from the very beginning means that anyone with this proof can disable the EC path, and thereby people would be forced to have a post-quantum fallback, or they would set themselves up to be disenfranchised of their coins. And even without a soft fork being negotiated to remove the EC signing.
That's exactly right. I highly recommend any interested listeners check out the mailing list thread. I believe it was called Giving Teeth to EC Disabling, started by Peter as well. And I think as I learn more about CISA and how it interplays with post-quantum, I start to realize that this problem is really the core dependent, or sorry, the core dependency that many other problems rely on solving, but nobody has yet fully solved it. And it's a worthwhile debate to be discussing.
Should we also talk about your contribution to the thread in terms of post-quantum snark aggregation?
Oh, yes. Yes, I'm sorry, I left off on that. So there is a technology called Succinct non-interactive arguments of knowledge, which let you prove that you executed a certain computation on certain inputs without necessarily forcing the person verifying your proof to have all of those inputs. And one thing that you can do with a snark is you can take a whole bunch of, say, large hash-based post-quantum signatures, verify them all against a bunch of pub keys on a bunch of different messages, and then produce a succinct proof that you executed that verification correctly. And this scales logarithmically with the number of signatures. So as you get more signatures, the size of the proof kind of caps off around a few hundred kilobytes. And I'm talking strictly about post-quantum snarks here. There are more succinct snarks, but they are not strictly post-quantum. There's also different assumptions that you can use to make the proofs smaller or faster, but I'm talking specifically about hash-based snarks here. And if you were to use, say, a hash-based snark to aggregate a whole bunch of hash-based signatures into a single proof, and then attach that to a block, well, now the size of any specific signature is asymptotically almost zero, which is almost the same behavior as CISA. It's just that we have to add this big block-wide proof, which is where most of the difficulty and complexity of this approach comes from. And this isn't new. This has been talked about before. I think Ethan Hailman proposed this, titling it BitZip, like a year or two back. And this trick, I think, might be a potential way to incentivize people to migrate to post-quantum cryptography in the same manner that CISA does, but without the caveat that it becomes useless after Q-day. It would persist after Q-day, but still provide incentive for people to migrate. Although there is a lot of complexity that comes with using snarks. You know, you have to design your circuits correctly. You have to make sure your verifier is sound. There are countless examples of snark proving and verification systems having soundness bugs. Like, for example, the recent Zcash infinite money glitch that was patched. And we don't know if anybody actually exploited it or not. We think not, but how do we know? And if we were to have that same soundness bug in Bitcoin using this SNARK signature aggregation system, it would mean that anyone who knows about this bug could, in theory, spend the coins of any other user as long as they're able to produce a valid proof.
Is there something about this proposal that requires it to be block-wide and not like transaction-wide?
Good question. The main constraint is the size. Unlike CISA, which has aggregated signatures of about 64 bytes, you need hundreds of kilobytes. Excuse me.
They're coming for you, Conduition.
Yeah,
sounds
you need
like New York singing you the song of its people.
And because the proof sizes are so big, if you aggregated these signatures on a per transaction basis, you could only fit maybe like at most 8 to 10 of these signatures. Or I say signatures; they would actually be aggregated proofs into a block. And this is the real rub, is that in order to deploy this, you need some mechanism for miners to either produce these proofs themselves in a reasonable amount of time before they start mining on a block template. Because remember, this is essentially a witness, which means it needs to be included in the witness commitment in the Coinbase transaction, which means that the miners have to produce it before they start mining. So, and then every time they want to change their block template, they change the different set of transactions that are in the block, they have to redo this whole proof. And creating a proof like this is expensive.
Seems like we'll probably be talking about these kind of ideas further into the future as well, but I appreciate you sort of going on a tangent with us in this particular discussion. I think maybe in the interest of time, we can move to the next quantum-related item, Conduition, that you participated in, titled Layered Quantum Recovery of Hashed Addresses. And this was a post, I think, on the mailing list and also delving by Shinobi. And maybe Conduition, I'll let you frame this one up for the audience. What's Shinobi getting at here? What's the story?
Yeah, so this is a post about recovery protocols. So for those not familiar, a recovery protocol is a way of rescuing legacy pre-quantum coins after Q-Day without any action from the user. This has a few caveats. This isn't possible for every UTXO. Only certain UTXOs can do this. And it relies on what I call knowledge asymmetries. And the idea of a knowledge asymmetry is that in the tool chain of Bitcoin, there's many different ways of deriving addresses. For example, you might have a public key that you hash, and or maybe you might have a script that you hash. You might use BIP32 to derive your secret key, which then turns into a public key, which you hash. There's a lot of different computational pipelines that all end up in a Bitcoin output. And some of those are actually quantum hard relations, by which I mean, if you give the quantum adversary your address, they might not necessarily be able to invert your address into your into a witness to that relation. So for example, a hashed address is a very simple example of a knowledge asymmetry. Provided that you've never exposed your public key, the quantum computer can't invert a hash function and find your public key. However, if you've exposed your public key before, there still are potential knowledge asymmetries because that key was most likely derived via BIP32. Specifically, BIP32 hardened derivation is a quantum hard relation, because even if you're given the public key and the quantum computer inverts it to get the secret key, you can't invert the hash function used by BIP32 to derive that secret key. And rescue protocols make use of these knowledge asymmetries. And what Shinobi is saying is that by layering different knowledge asymmetries, we can get more complete coverage of the UTXO set after Q-Day. Because, you know, most likely when Q-Day rolls around, not everyone will have migrated to Peta Merkle root or Peta Taproot v2 or whatever new output type is deployed. And so in order to prevent either mass theft or mass confiscation, we can deploy rescue protocols, which would let people rescue their coins using these knowledge asymmetries that are kind of baked into the UTXO set, not via consensus, but just via the tool chains that have been standardized around Bitcoin. My response to his initial post was that he had some claims that weren't exactly correct. He claimed that pay to Taproot was not rescuable. It is. There is a neat little thing in Taproot where every output is supposed to commit to a script or an empty script tree, even if it doesn't have any script spending conditions. And this actually constitutes a knowledge asymmetry, which you can use to rescue any Taproot output. He also said that you can cover 100% of coins. And that's also not true, because there are always going to be coins that don't have knowledge asymmetries. Case in point being pay to public key coins. JBOK, just a bunch of keys wallets, which were the standard before Bit32 existed. And those, if they are on a address with an exposed public key, those are also not rescuable. I tend to call these recoverable or unrecoverable coins, depending on whether they do or don't have a knowledge asymmetry.
Now, so the idea from Shinobi is to take some of these, and I guess we've covered some of these before. So like the BIP32 proofs, I think Roastbeef had something. I know Taj has done commit reveal related work. And so the idea is to sort of stitch these together in what he calls this layered approach. Is that the idea that he's come up with, or does he have additional proofs that he's adding to this?
No, that's the gist of his post, is that he's saying that by layering multiple knowledge asymmetries or multiple rescue protocols together, perhaps in combination with pre-registration, which is a different thing, we can achieve 100% coverage of the UTXO set, rescuing them all after Q day. I don't think that's true, because there are going to be coins that don't move in time, don't have knowledge asymmetries, and don't pre-register. And I gave a good, I had a reply that I actually sent a week ago, but I sent it without hitting reply all. So I just posted a further reply just earlier today, saying exactly this. There's always going to be some coins.
Kind of wishing you were breaking up for me. I don't know if it's for others as well. We may have slightly lost conduition. There's an interesting sort of parallel, I'd say, with some of the stuff that's gone on with Cold Card the last few weeks. I know some folks were trying to also determine what sort of knowledge asymmetry or hardware asymmetry there may be between somebody who's cracked another user's keys due to the bad entropy, and the person who actually had the device that generated the seed and the keys. Obviously, totally different when we're talking about, you know, post-quantum, but I know some folks have been working on that as well in the background with the Cold Card thing.
Yes, I sent a reply to Shinobi a week ago, but I forgot to hit reply all. I just resent it this morning.
What's the gist of that?
I was saying basically exactly the same thing that I said a minute ago, that you can't have 100% coverage. We're going to get the UTXO set that we're going to get, not the one we want on Q day. And we have to work with what we have. And when that comes around, we'll have to decide what rescue protocols we want to deploy and how, because some rescue protocols will confiscate coins and others won't. And that choice will be probably a very contentious one when the time comes.
Indeed. Anything else on this item, Conduition?
No, I think that's most of it.
All right. Well, thank you for joining for these two. You're welcome to hang on. We got a bunch of other things we're going to be talking about, but we understand if you have other things you're working on and need to drop.
Thanks. Yes, I've actually got some stuff I got to do today, but it's been a pleasure. And thank you all, guys.
Thanks, Conduition. Cheers.
Bye.
We're going to jump up to the news item. We had one item this week, and Ram has joined us to discuss this, titled Draft Bit for Stale Tip Relay. Maybe we can start with the basics. Ram, what is a stale tip, and why would we want to be relaying them?
Sure. I'll probably start with maybe what a stale block is. Maybe from there, we can probably understand why we're relaying only the tip. A stale block is basically a valid block that is no longer part of the active chain. So because block propagation is not instantaneous, two miners can potentially find blocks at roughly the same time for the same block height. And different parts of the network may see different blocks first. So there's essentially two valid blocks at the same height. And miners can only pick one to mine on top of, and the other block, which the miners didn't get to pick, effectively becomes stale. And just to clarify, this is not to be confused with an orphan block or an invalid block. And that's what a stale block is. Currently, we see around like one stale block every 1,000-1,500 blocks. This proposal, the idea of this proposal is not new. It's come up in earlier community discussions, including like comments from Greg Maxwell, Antoine Poinsot, when they were discussing like selfish mining and correlation to stale rates. Why relay stale blocks? Was that the follow-up question? Correct?
Yes.
Yeah. So at a high level, this proposal basically introduces like an opt-in P2P message for relaying recent stale chain tips. When I say tips, a stale branch can contain more than one block. So for more pedantic reasons, it's called tips because we are relaying only the tips and not the entire, just the block. And we relay like headers and stuff. So instead of the full block. And coming back to the point, like why relay? The main reason is observability. Like stale rate has direct correlation to block propagation. And the reason block propagation, like as a community, we've done enormous efforts in reducing the block propagation time with efforts like compact block relay, fiber. The main reason block propagation needs to be short is like, it keeps mining more decentralized. It keeps mining more like a lottery and less like a race. An increase in block propagation can lead to more miner centralization naturally. So we want to, stale rate is mostly like a proxy to measure block propagation time, and the frequency and the shape of the stale branches can tell us something about the health of the network. And for example, increase could point in slower block propagation times, or there are any validation bottlenecks or any regressions that we introduced in the software. It could also indicate if the network healed from a partition, or if miners are doing any adversarial mining strategies like selfish mining, famously or infamously, there are certain mining pools who are trending near the threshold to actually successfully perform selfish mining. So it's just purely for observability. The measuring stale rate actually does not detect that, okay, such an activity is being performed, but it can help us investigate what's going on in the network. An added side benefit is, you had a question.
No, just tell us about your added side benefit first.
Yeah, I was about to get to that. The added side benefit is if the chain undergoes a reorg, your stale block is already downloaded. So it's just like the reorg can be done faster. Like you have the block already downloaded and validated. So if the stale block happens to become an active part of the active chain, the reorg can be done faster as well. So that's an added side benefit.
Sorry, could you clarify? You said that only the tip is relayed, and you talked about headers being relayed, but now you're saying that the block is already downloaded. So do you mean that the entire block is propagated or just the header?
The stale tip message contains like a known fork point that the receiver knows already, and the headers leading up to the tip. So when the receiver gets that, they would try to construct the branch, and using the headers, they would request for the entire block details.
I see. So I was wondering, one of the concerns maybe with propagating more data is that there is a DOS vulnerability. Would you like to get into why propagating block headers of valid blocks is not a DOS vulnerability?
Yeah, on mainnet, like creating a valid header near the tip requires like real proof of work to be done. So that sort of prevents spam on the you can't like a malicious actor or malicious peer may not give you invalid stale tips. Hopefully that answers your question. But one thing it does not prevent is like attacker repeatedly sending invalid or replayed messages. In such an event, like I think the implementation has to apply like peer specific limits or global rate limits.
Well, we already have protections against invalid messages. I think we disconnect peers that send us invalid messages.
Yeah.
So Ram, there is some slight behavior change beyond just relaying this message, right? You mentioned the side benefit, actually having that block and doing the behavior of the node is changed other than some relaying of that observability. Okay.
Yeah.
Fabian?
I was curious about your choice for using BIP434 for signaling this, because I think since this is an opt-in feature for monitoring, basically, I would expect that not a lot of nodes enable this. So it would be interesting probably for the nodes to discover each other and connect, because if a node has a stale block, but then it doesn't have any other peers that are have this feature enabled, then maybe they cannot relay it. I was just curious about your rationale for this.
Like, are you suggesting like using something where it's discoverable in the gossip network that a node is capable of this feature before connecting?
Yes, exactly.
I think since this was an optional feature, we decided to use 434 mainly because this is an optional feature and it's not something of that interest. So maybe that's something we can follow up in the discussion.
It might make sense to explore whether it should be a service bit.
Yeah, that was considered, but I believe because 434 is a good way to actually negotiate optional features, I think that's what it was intentioned for. This seemed like a perfect fit for 434. But if the community feels there's more interest and in getting to know about nodes that advertise stale tips, we can potentially move through service bit.
Yeah, I think we can follow up offline.
That's a good question, Fabian. Thanks. I'll keep an eye.
Ram, what has reception been to the idea?
It's been fairly quiet. Mainly, sort of coincided right after the just before the cold card incident. So the community has been distracted since then. But I've gotten one off like direct feedback from a couple of developers that they're happy to see this effort being taken on. And one thing I should preface, this was a collaborative effort between like Ejitans, me, and another developer called VoxLT. And feedback has been good so far.
I would assume that the BNOC folks who do a lot of the monitoring would be having a strong opinion on wanting to have this information to be able to analyze the network.
Absolutely. I think getting stale tip information has required like special monitoring infrastructure, and there's not many that does it. OXP Tensi has a monitor. There's a fork monitor by BitMEX. So I know folks who are interested in P2P monitoring, I think they'll be specifically interested in this. Yeah.
All right, Ram, anything else before we wrap up this item?
No, that's all I had. Thank you so much for having me.
If listeners are curious, obviously check out the draft and comment accordingly. Ram, we appreciate your time. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much.
We'll jump back to the Changing Consensus segment for CISA, for Taproot KeyPath Spends, which is BIP 460. Fabian, we had you on a few weeks back to talk about BIP 459. Now we got 460. I think back in 459, you were sort of careful to say that signature aggregation is separate from the actual consensus change, right? How you might do the aggregation. And so maybe as a way to introduce 460, we can talk about maybe just quickly summarize 459 and I don't remember the BIP for that came out last year for half ag, but maybe you can sort of tie it all together and distinguish CISA from the other two components.
Yeah, the BIP editors were nice enough to reserve numbers, so we have consecutive numbers. It's 458, 459, and 460. Good to remember. The signature aggregation algorithms that we have are distinctive in the sense that 458, we use half aggregation, which is done on existing Schnorr signatures, so BIP 340 signatures. And these are aggregated in a process where the result is roughly half the size of the list of the signatures. And this process is non-interactive. And then in contrast to that, with 459, it's an interactive process where a fully aggregated signature is created, which has constant size of 64 bytes, so the same size of a single signature, independent of how many participants are in that process and how many signatures would have existed or how many messages are being signed. The key distinction that I also didn't make clear enough in the BIP initially, but that we improved on now, is that for the 459, there's no BIP 340 signatures existing beforehand. They never exist. They could exist in theory, but this aggregate signatures is created in this interactive process. These are the two choices that basically are available with BIP 460.
You mentioned those two choices, and then there's an explicit opt-out, right? So if you use the new witness version, you could also choose to not use either aggregation scheme?
Right. There's an explicit opt-out that's primarily because of adapter signatures, which is basically a way to hide information within a signature. And there are a couple of protocols that were built on top of that where adoption doesn't seem to be huge, but it's not clear. I mean, it's a nice privacy feature, so I mean, maybe we don't know about the usage patterns. This is definitely a feature that people would like to preserve. If it's not being used now heavily, maybe in potentially in the future it's going to be used more. That's why we want to have a way to opt out to make sure that on consensus level a certain signature can be preserved if we want to.
Could you maybe mention how the opt out works?
Yeah, so there's a marker byte depending on, and that basically tells you explicitly what the inputs are using. So for half aggregation, for full aggregation, and for opt-out, there's a specific marker byte that marks each of these cases.
Isn't that a privacy leak then, indicating which inputs are using adapter signatures potentially?
Sure. This is one issue with the proposal, I would say, or I'm not sure if it's really an issue. If you were to construct very unique ways of constructing a transaction with a combination, for example, of half aggregation, full aggregation, and opted out inputs, then this looks very unique and would be a very easy fingerprint to do. The question is that really a problem? Does that prevent potential future uses of protocols in that way? I'm not sure. I think for the DLC use case, for example, that's, I think, the biggest use case that I'm aware of for this kind of protocol. The information is usually out there anyway, what the DAP signature is. At least I'm not an expert on it, but at least as far as I know, so that potentially would be an example of an adapter signature where it's fine that people know that it's an adapter signature.
I think we kind of jumped into some of the mechanics here, and maybe given some of the discussions we've had over the years, it's obvious to people, but maybe Fabian, you can articulate for the audience why is this valuable? What are the benefits to Bitcoin and Bitcoin users of doing these types of aggregation?
Yeah, so the types of transactions that really profit from this are transactions that have a lot of inputs, and with each input so far, we typically associate a signature, when we can reduce the size of these signatures and aggregate them together, then we can save space, and space on the blockchain translates to costs, so we can save a lot of fees with this as well. And so there, the first kind of transaction that really comes to mind where there's a lot of inputs would be a consolidation transaction from big businesses. So these are a very easy win. They can save a lot of money when they consolidate their UTXOs, incentivize further that the UTXO set shrinks. But I think the use case that more listeners of the podcast probably will get excited about is that this also incentivizes usage of coin joins and pay joins. These types of transactions also usually have quite high number of inputs. Best practice, of course, you want to have a high anonymity set. These kinds of transactions can be cheaper than they are currently. And when you use it correctly, when there's wide adoption, they can potentially even be cheaper than just doing your own transactions in the usual way. So this is kind of the blockbuster feature that it makes privacy preserving usage of the Bitcoin protocol a lot cheaper.
Maybe we can talk to some of the feedback that you've received. Can you comment on Adam Gibson or Waxwing's questioning of the single group per scheme limit and how you're thinking about that?
Yeah, I think this is probably the most interesting question about the BIP right now for me, because it's the big question where I could still where I'm flexible to change my mind based on feedback from reviewers. So right now, what the BIP prescribes is basically you can have one half aggregation group, one bucket basically where signatures are put into it and then aggregated into one half aggregated signature. You can have one full aggregation bucket where a bunch of potential signatures are aggregated into one full aggregated signature, and you can have as many as you want of these opt-outs. But you cannot have two full aggregated signatures, for example, two full aggregated groups. So Waxwing's question was, why not have this as well? And my answer to it is basically that I don't really see a good use case for it. For half aggregation, it doesn't make sense anyway, because since it's non-interactive, you could just do it anyway. You don't really like, there's no reason not to do it, basically. Two buckets really don't make any sense. But with full aggregation, it could maybe make sense, but I don't think anyone really has come up with a good use case for this. Merch, you have a comment?
Yeah, I mean, if you're building a transaction with multiple users, so maybe the idea would be that you have two groups of people that want to build a transaction together, and each of the groups wants to aggregate their transactions together and then add them to one transaction. So a second signature versus just one signature is just 64 bytes difference. If there's a lot of inputs for both of these, they could just make their own transactions in the first place. And otherwise, they're already collaborating to create a partially signed Bitcoin transaction, sending that around, adding the signatures, finalizing together. So why wouldn't they be able to also aggregate the signatures together into a single group? So I think I haven't thought that deeply about it, but I'm not sure I see why having two groups would make more sense if you're already collaborating to create a transaction together.
Yeah. The only fun part about it, we were musing about this a bit on the mailing list, is that if you would have these multiple fully aggregated groups, then you could half aggregate the signatures of these again. Probably, like, there's no proof for that, but I think we want to keep complexity of course low. This is already a complicated enough proposal, so unless somebody has a really good idea of how this could be used, then we should probably rather leave it at that. Going away from complexity, there's basically the other side that I want to talk about as well, which wasn't on the mailing list, I think, but I received this feedback in another venue as well. So there's also a potential idea to step in the other direction and go simpler than the proposal is currently. And that would be to say, okay, we can only either have a full aggregation of the full transaction of all the signatures that are, of all the inputs that are here, or we can have one half aggregation of all of the signatures or inputs that are in here, or nothing, basically, or full opt-out, basically. And that would allow us to save these markers. But we would then basically have no flexibility. In this case, early on when I had the first draft of this BIP, I asked around for some feedback on value of this kind of flexibility, and people generally said that they would like to have this flexibility for potential more interesting use cases. However, if people strongly advocate for the even simpler version, then I would be very happy to consider it, because for the blockbuster use cases that are just laid out for these consolidation transactions and for pay join, coin join, at least in the plain way that you can imagine, these work as well.
Fabian, I think when people hear, you know, draft BIP, they're thinking of you know, reading the text on the pull request, but there's other work that you've done as part of the PR. Can you talk about SecP256K1 lab and what's in there, and maybe also what other development has been going on around this proposal?
Yeah, personally, I just always feel a lot more secure to look at code than to look at prose text. That just gives me security to see that actually works what I'm thinking about. So pretty early on, I started to implement stuff. There was already a half aggregation pull request to SecP ZKP. Pretty early on, which was built by somebody working for Blockstream temporarily, and I ported this to SecP, and I maintained this pull request. There's a full aggregation pull request to the SecP repository, which I have built, which is implementing the Dahlias protocol. And then there is also a draft pull request. No, I don't think I've actually opened the pull request yet, but there's a draft branch for the implementation of the CISA transaction-wide proposal in Bitcoin Core. And you mentioned SecP Lab. So I haven't really done anything directly within SecP Lab, but I've used SecP Lab basically as the dependency to then build on top of that the reference implementations in Python within each of the BIPs. So that's a nice way to make that simpler. Kind of has turned out to be kind of the standard of similar BIPs in the recent past. And so I had the initial Python implementations standalone, but then basically put all of them on top of that, and the CISA transaction-wide implementation then pulls in these each of these implementations and then builds on top of that.
Excellent. Yeah, I wanted to bring that up because I think, you know, listeners may be interested in the BIP text, but there's also, you know, functioning code that you know, potentially listeners would want to play with or do something different with. And so, yeah, I guess call to action for people to jump into that as well. Fabian, anything else you'd say as we wrap up this item?
No, just very happy to receive further feedback. I know other things have been on people's minds in the last 2 weeks, I'm also very happy. Like it already came up here earlier in the call. I initially actually thought that when I finally go out and talk about this more publicly, that post-quantum people would just tell me that I'm an idiot to still work on this obsolete technology. As Conduition has also said, there's potentially even ways to potentially have them work together and actually make each other stronger, which is very interesting. And I personally haven't really spent that much time on post-quantum stuff, just followed it from the sidelines, but that, even that wasn't fully possible all the time. I'm going to look into this further in the future and explore as well the ideas that we discussed already.
I think, there's an interesting synergy there with potentially creating a financial incentive for post-quantum adoption. And since the script path is already excluded from the aggregation anyway, it doesn't really matter much if there's post-quantum leaves or EC leaves in the script tree. So, that's I hadn't considered that, but that's actually an interesting, nice little synergy.
Yeah, I agree.
Fabian, thanks for your time. Thanks for your work on these proposals. And if you have other things you're working on, you're free to drop. But we appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me.
Cheers. Next item from our Changing Consensus segment titled SegWit Commitment to Post-Quantum Witness Data. This was, I believe, a Peter Wulla post as well. And maybe we'll set the stage here. We don't have a guest for this one, but we talked about how post-quantum signatures are of larger size, even though there's been a lot of research to decrease those. And if Bitcoin were to adopt those signatures, they'll need to live somewhere inside the transactions. And I guess maybe the obvious answer might be to put on a second witness area, the way that SegWit added the first one many years ago. But there's some overhead that Peter brought up in terms of costs to the community in terms of being able to deploy that. And I think it really focuses around, you know, potentially having a third transaction identifier. So we have TXIDs, SegWit, then you have witness, your WTXIDs, you have new Coinbase commitments, all kinds of things that change in the mining software, peer-to-peer logic. And so juggling a third ID then for every transaction, I think is in Peter's mind a little bit prohibitive or a challenge that should be worth putting some time towards eliminating. Maybe I'll pause there. Merch?
Yeah, it would just be a lot of extra work. And so from my superficial understanding of this proposal, just adding the commitment to the witness data instead of committing at the non-witness level to the quantum section would allow the witness TXID to cover the additional data. And that way we wouldn't need all of that overhead. We could still continue to do peer-to-peer transaction traffic based on witness TXIDs. The witness commitment would still suffice. So we would still have a new section for the quantum data, but it would be committed to in the witness data. And that way it would be easier and maybe less work to roll out. I didn't anticipate it because Peter had been saying for a few years that he was going to let other people have their turn with proposing protocol changes and working on it. But I'm pretty happy that Peter has recently picked up an interest on the whole quantum topic because he brings a lot of experience to the design of such proposals.
Well, I think he just said it was a shower thought or something. So yeah, he's still not involved. He's just having a shower thought. That's all. Maybe to elaborate slightly, I think what he's talking about here, instead of having this a new TXID, he's having this idea of styles, where style zero would be like today's SegWit, and then style one in this brainstorm would be post-quantum data. And then you would, in theory, have more styles, values two and above for future usage. And then there was a note that, you know, nodes that don't understand a certain style could be shown the valid style zero commitment instead. So on unupgraded nodes can continue to keep working. There was some feedback here from AJ Towns comparing the different styles to distinct authorization weight formulas. And then he also suggested annex-based commitments potentially as well, and some potential advantages there. Yeah.
Yeah, so one of the points is that if we had humongous quantum signatures, we might be interested in having a different discount for the quantum section. Because let's face it, currently our signatures take 64 bytes, but they only weigh 16 V bytes. And if we moved to a scheme that had maybe 3,000 bytes of signatures and 2,000 bytes of public keys or similar, with 5,000 bytes per input, we would drastically reduce the throughput on the Bitcoin network. Now, currently, block space is a little underdemanded, maybe with fee rates being around a quarter sat per V-byte. But if the quantum data were that cheap, if quantum data were that expensive and quantum inputs introduced such large outputs, I think we might overshoot and block space demand would go through the roof, or fee rates would go through the roof as the block space market would be much more competitive.
Yeah, so I think, yeah, maybe to wrap up and riff off of what Merch just said. Yeah, so what Peter's saying, yeah, there, this idea of a style and the approach to doing this is still going to require a soft fork, and you're still going to have the storage question, like Merch mentioned. You're still going to have peer-to-peer upgrades as part of something like this. But the win that he is getting at is to avoid this new transaction identifier, which has the invasive parts that we mentioned earlier in the discussion. Anything else on this one, Merch or Gustavo? Okay. Input triggered transaction expiry. Merch, you have a bit of a lead.
Well, sorry. So my understanding is that the problem that leads to this proposal is, if you have transactions that expire, you could use this expiration to freely relay data across the network. And then before the transaction actually is eligible or interesting to include in blocks, it would expire and not be allowed. It would be a free relay vector. So this proposal is trying to introduce an expiration for transactions that is based on when the parent transaction confirmed. So there would always be some cost to the user of this transaction. And that was roughly what I took out of it. But
merge the cost being the parent transaction confirming and right. thus you the fees paid.
Yeah.
As opposed to just relaying transactions that don't have a, I guess, related parent that is confirmed. Is
yeah.
that the idea? Okay.
Maybe. Honestly, I struggled a bit with this item. Generally, there was a lot of pushback against expire opcodes because of A, the free relay problem, and B, it could introduce some hard-to-analyze game theory around juicy transactions being about to expire, and people maybe reorging in order to mine a block that could include a transaction that just expired. Generally, the only form of expiration we have so far is by creating a conflicting transaction that spends one of the inputs, which makes the expiring transaction invalid instead. And I stared at this one a bit, but this is the best I have for explaining what's going on here.
I don't have the newsletter number or podcast number handy, but we did have similar proposals, absolute expiry proposals like Peter Todd's op expire that would make a valid transaction later invalid. You still have the cheap relay of potentially spam unless policy demands were near next block fees. There's some consideration around that when we spoke about that one. Merch, why do we want to have a transaction that expires again at all? Why are these efforts being put forth at all? What's the use case?
I guess you kind of want to have the option of things only becoming valid after some time in order to do transactions that have options, such as HTLCs, hash time lock contracts, where as long as a hash is provided, you can spend it immediately. But after some time, there's a fallback. If the payment on the Lightning Network or otherwise doesn't go through, eventually the sender gets back their money, right? So similarly with escrows or channel opens or other UTXO sharing mechanisms, you want to be able to have a transaction where you commit to something happening, but have a way to back out if the other person just drops off the face of the earth. And in expire construction could sort of bring the other side of this, where you explicitly say, I'm happy to do this, but only to that point. Once that block passes, I'm no longer in on this. You have until then to decide or something like that. Maybe to give a limited time option for something. But we sort of can, in a roundabout way, do these things already by having the back out transaction be an explicit thing that conflicts and eliminates the first option. There are just some weird dynamics around having the expiration with the free relay and potentially weird game theory.
I think we can wrap up that item. We'll move to the last changing consensus item this week/month, segregated data, BIP draft. Obviously, we've talked a lot as a Bitcoin community over the last few years about people stuffing arbitrary data into the Bitcoin blockchain using a variety of mechanisms, op return, witness data. It's sort of a perennial controversy. This item was from Mr. Hash, who I believe posted to Delving Bitcoin, a soft fork draft. And he took a different angle on this. He says, instead of fighting the data, we give it, I think people have talked in the past about a dedicated garbage can being op return. Well, maybe this is like a dedicated attic to put this arbitrary data in. So this would be a separate and prunable part of a block designated for data. The confusion on my side is what the incentive is to keep it if you're able to prune it. Mircea, I know you brought up some questions on this. I mean,
yeah, let me try to steel man it a little more first. So the general idea is we know that people will always be able to insert data because Bitcoin transactions are based on script programming. Programming languages always have nooks and crannies where you can stuff data in. So the idea would be if we explicitly create a space where people can put data, they don't have to play games with it. They just put the data there. And the adoption incentive would be that it would be slightly cheaper than currently established mechanisms such as witness data stuffing. So with the inscription envelope, of course, you have to have the output that commits to the data in the first place. Then you have an input that fulfills the output commitment and then has an inscription envelope, for example, where it has the data. So you have the overhead of the additional output and input, and that is slightly inefficient. And then the inscription data itself is, I think, cut into pieces with up pushes. So by having just an up data output or whatever it would be called exactly, you would be able to directly write to witness data or to a section of data that is discounted exactly like witness data by a factor 4. But you would lose the overhead of having an output that commits to it and an input that publishes it, but would just directly commit with an output to here's a sec data section, and you can write whatever data there. Now, the way to limit it would be that the sec data counts towards the block weight limit, but on the other hand, is not evaluated because there's it's just a blob. So there's no signatures in it. There's no validation beyond just a hash that the blob hashes to a specific commitment in the output. But it would count towards the weight limit, which means that these people would pay fees for the blob and would compete for block space for the blob and thereby be limited in how much data blob they can insert into blocks. The initial construction was proposing that for 100 or 1,000 blocks from the chain tip, every node is required to have the blob data and serve it. And then once the block falls out of the window at the chain tip, peers or nodes catching up with IBD wouldn't need to have the blob data, and thereby it would become automatically prunable after that depth. I don't remember, it was 100 or 1,000 blocks. Some of the people that responded to this idea pointed out that if eventually it is not required by consensus, it is de facto not required by consensus because implementers could just choose to ignore it from the get-go. And the proposal was then amended to make the data optional in the first place. So it would still count towards weight, and the nodes that implement this optional data check would check that the data is not too big or otherwise not accepted transactions. But so I think the main doubt of reviewers here was if the data is optional, and generally data embedding doesn't seem to be super popular among the Bitcoin ecosystem, except in some NFT pushing subsegment. Would there even be enough nodes that serve this data? Otherwise, why wouldn't the people that want to embed data into the blockchain just embed it in the witness for a tiny extra cost and then get full data availability? And yeah, that's, I think, roughly where people are hung up on. Is like, sure, it's a just tiny little bit cheaper, and it's sort of the blessed harm reduction. But if the data is not available and it doesn't actually fulfill the need, the want of the data embedders, then why would they ever decide to use it? And is that then worth the effort of making a soft fork? Yeah. Any more questions, comments? Or I think otherwise, I think that's pretty much where the discussion was left off.
Yeah, I think listeners can jump into the thread. I think there was quite a bit of back and forth. I think Merch summarized, you know, the takeaways from that back and forth nicely. But if folks are curious about the proposal, jump into that delving thread and check the back and forth on the comments. That wraps up our Changing Consensus segment. We'll move to releases and release candidates. We have one this week. I already somewhat spoiled it, but I won't spoil it further. What do we have, Gustavo?
Can you guys hear me well?
Yep.
Perfect. Yes, this week we have one release, LipSec 256K1, LipSec P, version 0.8. So here we add the new model for silent payments that we discussed, I believe, two episodes ago. That is the main component of this release. But also a few newsletters ago, precisely in newsletter 396, we talked about a new API function that allows a user to supply a custom SHA-256 compression function at runtime. So that is also part of this release. And additional optimizations, 64-bit field arithmetic that is improved, that produces signature verification speedups of up to 11% in some builds. So also what I wanted to point at is that we didn't include it in this release, in this newsletter, but an important maintenance release from BTC Pay Server was announced the day we drafted this newsletter. So users of BTC Pay Server are advised to update to version 2.42, particularly if you use LND, because the vulnerability affects LND users within BTC Pay Server. So if anybody's listening that uses BTC Pay Server, please update immediately, particularly if you use LND. Also, I believe that if not upgrading is not sufficient, you should also be reviewing your macaroon files, which are the credentials for accessing your LND node, since that the vulnerability was around an attacker being able to obtain those credentials in an unauthenticated way, an unauthorized way. So you should also consider swapping those credentials in case they were ever obtained by an attacker. So, yes, Mike.
Okay, perfect. I'm giving you the thumbs up.
So we move forward with the next section, notable code and documentation changes. We got a lot of bug fixes this week. It seems to be that we're going to have a few weeks like that, considering all the new vulnerabilities that are being exposed. The first one, Bitcoin Core 35501, isn't a bug fix. This is a new feature that basically allows the Bitcoin Core wallet to store multiple variants of the same transaction that have the same transaction ID, but have different witness transaction IDs. So here, previously, the wallet would simply ignore any transaction that had the same transaction ID as one that was already stored, even if it had a different witness transaction ID. The main goal here is to be able to have multiple variants of the same transaction in order to compare them related to their, if we were going to replace a transaction through like a fee bump through RBF, we could look at all the variants of the transaction and choose the one that would have the lowest weight, and that would be the one to get fee bumped. That was one of the motivations, but Merch, please jump here.
Yeah. How could you ever have a fee bump with a transaction where the TX ID doesn't change? I wanted to dig a little bit here. So imagine you had multiple different ways of spending a pay to taproot output. For example, you could have a script path output that is a 203 multisig, which is maybe a little more sizable. But then after the two participants that can sign for the 203 multisig sign for that transaction input, the third party comes online and you manage to instead make a key path spend that uses the music that is stored in the key path of all three signers. And now you only have to pay for a key path input instead of a script path input. And you could do that without changing the TX ID, just changing the witness data to the single signature instead of revealing in the input where that script leaf was, the script leaf script and the 203 multisig construction and their signatures, you would replace all that with a single music signature. So now the transaction would have the same TX ID, the same inputs and outputs, the same fee paid, but the witness data would be smaller, and thus the transaction might have sufficiently higher fee rate to replace the original. And if that happened previously, I'm not entirely sure. I think that we did propagate transactions with different witness TX IDs and they could replace others. But honestly, don't nail me down on that. But now your wallet would also store more than one, would be able to store more than one of those in Bitcoin Core.
Very interesting. Thank you much for that extra detail. Well, I was wondering, is there other cases where this happens? For example, if you were to use a high S signature versus a low S signature, would that also produce a similar situation where the transaction ID is the same, but the witness transaction ID is different?
Correct. The witness TX ID is malleable. I think that high S's are not consensus valid, though, in SegWit. But happy to be corrected in the comments below.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that's the case for Taproot specifically. And in SegWit, they're non-standard, but they're still consensus valid. So this is now the goal of this item is now for the wallet to store all the variants. There's still one that is chosen as canonical. It is often the one that is confirmed. But if none is confirmed, then it's the one that contains witness data. And if multiple transactions contain witness data, then it's the one with the lowest weight. There's also, now this is also exposed to several RPC commands, get transaction, list transaction, and list since block. Those RPC commands now report these variants in a new field called alternate witness transaction IDs. So that's for the Bitcoin Core repo. And the next items are from Core Lightning, Eclair, LND, and Rust Bitcoin and BTC Pay Server. We begin with Core Lightning 9298. This item is about the advancement to migrating to a new system called BWatch. So BWatch is an experimental blockchain washing plugin that moves the block polling and the transaction filtering logic out of Lightning, the Lightning daemon. So the intention here of BWatch is to move away from an implementation in the Lightning daemon that was storing unnecessarily a lot of the blockchain data that was already present in the blockchain node we connect to. Lightning D was simply replicating a lot of that data, storing unnecessarily data. Now, instead, the Lightning daemon simply tells BWatch, can you watch these transactions for me, these crypt pub keys, and also track these UTXOs? And BWatch will connect to the Bitcoin node and will let the Lightning daemon know when a transaction is found that matches its requirements. So, and also this allows eventually another system could be integrated. Since this is now abstracted, BWatch is simply the first implementation of an external system that is monitoring the blockchain. But the surface could allow for another plugin to play that role, and instead of BWatch. So this pull request specifically moves the wallet transaction and the UTXO tracking to this new system by introducing new tables in BWatch, specifically our outputs and our transactions. However, these are temporarily mirrored still to the Lightning Daemon, to the legacy tables. So for example, if you were to use BWatch and you would like to downgrade back to the previous implementation, you could easily still go back and forth since all this data is still mirrored to the previous tables. So this is an experimental feature that requires activation with a specific flag called experimental BWatch. Next item, from the core Lightning repo 9353. Here, this is a bug fix where previously SendPay, which is a core Lightning RPC command for sending a payment, when it would have it now returns an RPC error when the combined payload of each hop doesn't fit the limit that is defined by Bolt 4, which basically says that the combined per hop payload cannot exceed 1300 bytes. So previously, it would simply return a null result and it would later cause the daemon to crash. So now this is just an error handling that avoids a potential crash when the combined per hop payload exceeds the limit that is defined by Bolt 4. So just a simple fix to ensure that the node doesn't crash. The next item, Eclair 3336. Here, there was an issue where if a user or a peer, or a component within the Eclair node duplicated an HTLC settlement message, and that would get added to the remote, that message was added multiple times to the proposed remote commitment changes, then when exchanging commit signature messages with the peer and receiving a signature that didn't match the remote commitment change state that we had stored that had duplicate messages, then that could lead Eclair to a potential forced close of that channel when it would basically see that there was a mismatch between the signature that it received from its peer and what it stored as remote commitment changes. So now Eclair simply prevents that duplicate message from updating the state that it has for the remote commitment changes. So later on, when it exchanges signatures with the peer, there's no mismatch that was caused from that duplicate message. And then there's also no forward close of that channel. So here, once again, a small technicality that would lead to an issue. And now that is fixed to avoid Eclair unnecessarily for closing a channel. The next item, LND 10942. This is a new feature that LND didn't have, which is when forwarding an HTLC on specifically a blinded payment path, the encrypted recipient data can identify the next hop using its node ID or its short channel ID. LND had implemented when forwarding an HTLC on a blinded payment path, LND was always expecting that the recipient data would identify the next hop through the short channel ID. However, Core Lightning uses the next node ID format, which basically would let a node know, hey, this is the node ID, and the node LND, for example, has to choose a specific channel to forward the HTLC from. So this is simply an update in the LND implementation to now accept next node ID on top of short channel ID. And this enables LND to be interoperable with Core Lightning when forwarding an HTLC on a blinded payment path. I would also like to specify that LND has implemented blinded paths for a while, but only for Bolt 11 payments and the Bolt 12 implementation is right now being built. However, it's not finalized, but this is a fix that would require once LND ships Bolt 12 payments, then it will be interoperable with Core Lightning. The next item, LND 10,992. Here, there's a new limit that is added when LND node that is just syncing with the chain and sends a message called query channel range. This message, this request message is sent to a peer to obtain the channel announcements and synchronize with the network, with the state of the Lightning network. However, there was previously no the bound of the memory used when synchronizing these channel announcement messages was extremely big, which could cause an attacker to send to LND a huge amount of fake channel announcements that could potentially cause an LND node to run out of memory and potentially even crash. So did the attack or and the issue wasn't necessarily identified. This is more a theoretical analysis on, at least it seems so, from what has been disclosed so far. But now there's a new limit, and LND now simply accepts a maximum of 100,000 short channel IDs per message, or in aggregate for a single query, it's the same limit as well. The reason why this amount this of 100,000 was chosen is because currently the Lightning Network has a lower an amount of channels that is lower than that. I believe when I last checked, it was closer to 60,000 channels. Although it has gone higher in the past, it has never surpassed 100,000. So it is expected that from the discussion in the pull request that the LND maintainers would update this limit if it ever came that the Lightning Network would have a higher amount of channels than the one it is limited at now. So now your LND node will simply not even accept a message that has more than 100 short channel IDs in a single query. Next item, now we get to the Rust Bitcoin repo. So the first item, 6364. This is a new feature that is added to Rust Bitcoin, where support for encoding and decoding BIP-434 messages is now implemented. So BIP-434, as we've discussed in newsletter 286 and 390, is a protocol that defines a specific message, a peer-to-peer message called feature, that allows peers to announce and negotiate support for new features. So Rust Bitcoin simply implements the basic message infrastructure, the wiring required for implemented BIP-434. Compared to Bitcoin Core's implementation, this is simply the first phase of that implementation. Bitcoin Core also implemented the negotiation mechanism where feature has to be sent after Virac. So, between version and Virac. So, however, in the Rust Bitcoin case, only the encoding and decoding support for this type of message is implemented. And I believe because Rust Bitcoin is simply a library and not specifically a node implementation, that is also part of the reasoning why it has only implemented this level of support. Next item, still on the Rust Bitcoin repo, 6642. Here, another bug fix. So Rust Bitcoin has a specific limit to each transaction witness element, and it caps that limit at 4 megabytes. That limit, of course, is derived from the fact that a Bitcoin block can never be bigger than 4 megabytes if it had or a 4 million weight unit block limit. However, Rust Bitcoin will, of course, never accept in the end a witness element that is 4 megabytes because there are other rules that cap the transaction size and even the witness element size. But when receiving a transaction from a peer, Rust Bitcoin will, or from an external source, Rust Bitcoin will first run a check that each witness element cannot be bigger than 4 megabytes. However, when decoding a transaction, the bug was that only the first witness element, only the limit was only applied for the first witness element, and further witness elements would reset to a default larger limit of 32 megabytes. Excuse me, I forgot how to say it much. The point is that the second and the third and the so on witness elements would have a larger limit, and for example, they could pass higher than 4 megabytes. And this was still bound to the peer-to-peer message limit of 5 megabytes. So it was impossible for a witness element to be higher than 5 megabytes because of the peer-to-peer message limit. However, the second witness element could be between 4 and almost 5 megabytes in size. The problem was that if an attacker sent us a transaction with a witness element that was between 4 and 5 megabytes, not the first one, but the ulterior ones, they were not properly caught. And then it would lead to an inconsistent state that could cause a panic because some code would simply not count the witness element amount. So it would say there's 4 witness elements here, but because they had they were bursting through the expected limit of 4 megabytes, they were not properly rendered when trying to after being decoded. So that could lead to a panic, and specifically, it was noted that it would happen in the case when of a taproot spend. So now we just make sure, Rust Bitcoin simply makes sure that this 4 megabyte size limit is now applied at each witness element. It never gets dropped after the first element, so that later on, when after decoding. Because it would be accepted during decoded, it wouldn't lead to the inconsistent state that would then cause the panic. So now, during decoding, we just catch those witness elements that are higher than the limit and simply reject them before going deeper down in the process. So now we get to the two final items of this newsletter, both from the BTC Pay server repository. So the first one is a bug fix in the authentication system of the Greenfield API. So it was observed that an attacker could potentially bypass the 2FA in the authentication handler of the API if you had set up specifically time-based one-time passwords. For FIDO2 2FA, which is also known, referred as passkey authentication, that was properly handled. However, an attacker could bypass the time-based one-time password 2FA. There's another item that I didn't put here, but now also basic authentication is now shut down. Excuse me, is now disabled for the first 5 minutes of the user account creation. So this is in combination with this. The next release also, this is item, 7492, but it comes together with 7491, where 7491, like I explained, fixes the issue that you could bypass the time-based one-time password for 2FA. But 7492 comes together with it because it also disables basic authentication, which means email and password by default 5 minutes after account creation. And the final item from the BTC Pay server repo and the final item of this list is 7488, which improves signing compatibility with the latest version of the Blockstream Jade, and also when used with newer hardware wallet interface versions. Here the fix is simply to add witness UTXO fields to SegWit inputs when the PSBT already contains the corresponding previous transaction in non-witness UTXO. So this resolves an issue with the Blockstream Jade specifically. And also there's another fix where in the user interface, a multi-sig transaction would appear as pending, even though it had already been properly signed and finalized by all. The signing had been finalized by all parties. So now the fix makes it so that the signing status doesn't become stale and properly updates when it has been properly signed. It will display as so instead of remaining pending forever. So that's the last item of this list, and that completes the newsletter and the episode.
Thanks, Gustavo, for walking us through that and also for co-hosting. And thank you, Merch, also for co-hosting. And we want to thank Conduition, Fabian, and Ram for joining us on this episode and for you all for listening. Cheers.